Tonight we're going to basically cover a huge swath of the Roman Catholic Church in the 19th century. And there's a lot that happens here, but I think we can really boil it down to kind of the major hot points that we're going to discuss tonight. The period between 1789 and 1914 is the period we're going to cover, looking primarily at Roman Catholicism. And I think a good title for this period of Roman Catholic history is Victory and Vicissitudes. And that just simply means changes in fortune, both positively and negatively at times. And that very much was the case during this period, both partial highs and really big lows during this period of Roman Catholicism. The Roman Catholic Church suffered the loss of the vast majority of her temporal possessions and a lot of its political influence during this period. This period from basically the French Revolution to World War I. It was a period that really changed the dynamic of Roman Catholicism. What had kind of been the most influential body in Europe up to this point really lost that influence and became just really a simple branch of Christianity. It's really what it became. It became these branches of Christianity during this period really kind of are almost secularized in a way. Kind of people began just becoming Protestant on the side, Catholic on the side, Eastern Orthodox on the side. That's just another part of one's identity. Rather than being pretty much everything they were. You were either all Roman Catholic, all Protestant, all Eastern Orthodoxy. But here it very much kind of became another identifier that someone was. And with that came a really ignominious fate for the papacy. The papacy really has a major decline with really one high point, but pretty much a gradual decline of its power from this point forward and its authority, which is a marked contrast to the Counter-Reformation period, basically from the mid-16th century up into the mid-18th century. Really, the Counter-Reformation is the high peak of Roman Catholic missions, Roman Catholic spread, and Roman Catholic supremacy. And after that, it's pretty much a gradual decline from that point forward. After the Napoleonic Wars in Europe, Romanticism began to bloom against the rationalism that so dominated the 18th century. And with that, Catholicism regained a lot of its former prestige and power up until 1870. And from 1870 to 1940, the story of Rome was one of loss, prestige, and a growing rise of anti-clericalism throughout the countries of Europe. So that's going to be kind of the three periods we're going to break this up into, from 1789 to 1815 with the fall of Napoleon, from 1850 to 1870, which is the rise of Romanticism, kind of a resurgence of Roman Catholicism, and then from 1870 to 1914, which is the beginning of World War I. That's kind of the major periods that we're going to cover tonight. The difficulties that Roman Catholicism faced during this period primarily grew out of the problem of its relationship to the national churches that had begun to develop during this period. The nation-state idea becomes huge in the 18th century. The idea of a Roman Empire, a Holy Roman Empire, a European empire altogether really falls off the map. And now nations are really focusing on becoming sovereign and autonomous. That really is the idea that happens in the 19th century. And by 1870, Germany and Italy had emerged as national states. And these states set out to limit the power of the Pope in their countries because they saw the Pope as a threat. This was a threat of trying to maintain some kind of universal appeal, some kind of imperial concept, and they were not going to have it. The revolutions in France, America, and in Latin America that occurred in the 50 years from 1776 to 1826 stimulated national control by the state in order to become or maintain freedom from Roman Catholic power. And it's like I said, as we talked about in previous lectures, in states where monarchy was supreme, usually Roman Catholicism fit well in those certain countries because it was usually ties between the king and the Pope. where republicanism was a bigger thing, where the idea of people's autonomy in the nations, Protestantism always flourished because it put a higher priority on the individual rather than the monarchy and a corporate state. So usually where these nation states developed, Protestantism flourished, not always in the best forms, but nevertheless, it flourished nevertheless. And that brings us to really our first period tonight, and that is looking at revolutions and the papacy, 1786 to 1850. The French Revolution that happened, and we briefly touched on it already, was the product of a vast number of things. There was really no one thing you could point it to. There was bad economic issues, social, political, legal conditions that were all horrific. And then the French had positive examples of revolution to look at. The English Revolution in the 17th century and the very recent American Revolution that they helped play a part in just years before. And on top of those successful revolutions, we've already seen there was this growing anti-Christian idea with the philosophes and the philosophical atheists that were developing there, and with that also a populist ideology, focusing on the desires of the people rather than the monarchy. And all of this created the perfect stew and concoction for revolution. And the state of the Roman Catholic Church didn't really help itself and provide any sentiment to which the French would want to care very much about it. Rome had massive ownership of land in France. It owned vast amount of land, territories, buildings, castles, and it amassed an unbelievable amount of revenue every year. The kind of money that the Roman Catholic Church was bringing in was just astronomical. And so French society didn't think very well of that, especially when you have a populist movement that's going, why are we giving money to these rich clergymen who are parts of the aristocracy? And so it didn't necessarily go very well. In 1789, the National Assembly of France declared that church lands were now public property. And it issued bonds that were redeemable in parcel of land. And then in 1790, monasteries were completely abolished by law in France. And in the summer of the same year, the assembly passed the civil constitution of the clergy, which reduced the number of bishops to 83, from thousands to 83 in a single law. And that 83 was a number that corresponded to the provincial units in France. So basically, there was one bishop for every provincial unit. These bishops were not allowed to be appointed by the church. They actually had to be voted on by people. People voted on the bishops of the province, just like you would vote on a sheriff in a city now. You were voted on, you voted your bishop in, and the Pope was only supposed to be notified of the choice. He had no say in who the bishops were in France. So you can see the Pope's just losing all of his power at this point, and the church is really becoming secularized. This is the epitome of a state church here. You have the law who has totally changed the ideas, and now churches are becoming public property. And in order to use that property for worship, you actually have to rent out the land as a church if it's for religious purposes. You have to pay an extra rent fee if you're using that land for religious purposes. So don't tell me this kind of stuff can't happen in a revolution and a changing of a culture. This went from being one of the most religious nations in Europe to being the most anti-Christian nation in Europe within a decade. It's a fascinating reality, and it's something that we should learn from history. History teaches us a lot of things. Clergymen were paid by the state, and they, the order for them to receive their income, they had to take an oath of loyalty to the state first. This is very much what happens currently in the state church in China. That Chinese officials actually appoint certain officials, Christian leaders, and I say that in air quotes, because these individuals have to take an oath to Xi Jinping and basically make sure that his pictures are the one up. They can only preach certain parts and certain things, lots of loyalty to the state. And so there's two completely different churches in China. There's the state church, which is no church at all, and then there is the true Christian church, which is underground and persecuted. At this point in France, the Pope's only power was that he was allowed to state the dogma of the Roman Catholic Church. That's it. He can't pick leaders. He can't have any oversight as to what's happening there. He can only say, this is what is de fide. This is what is dogma of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, while many of the clergy didn't really care about the fact that they lost the lands, I mean, for them it was what it was, they were violently opposed to the secularization of the church, and because of this, within 5 years, 4,000 Catholic clergy left France. Just an exodus out of it. And the Roman Catholic Church and the French state were completely separated in 1793 and 94 by the Reign of Terror. The Reign of Terror was really the low point of the revolution. This was when the guillotine was just going crazy. It basically, the revolution turned on itself. It was who can be, well, we would say woke enough today, but for them it was who can be revolutionary enough. Even Robespierre, kind of this anti-Christian revolutionary, started seeing it get out of hand and was like, whoa, whoa, we need to slow down. And they cut his head off. Because they're like, you're not revolutionary enough, man. And once again, history repeats itself. Nothing new under the sun. For the first time, financial support for the church became voluntary. At this point, it was a part of your regular taxes that went to the church. Everyone had to do it, but now, for the first time ever, it became completely voluntary, your giving to the church. And many atheistic leaders tried to replace Catholicism altogether with a new national religion, a religion they called the cult of reason, the religion of reason. And they even tried to form an idol for this cult of reason. They had this young actress and opera singer come into Notre Dame, and they put a crown on her head and they painted her and they called her the goddess of reason. This is what we want. We want to start a cult of reason. That is our true religion. The religion of reason and rationality. And though many didn't go as far as crowning a goddess or anything like that, they did accept the change to the calendar. They shifted the national calendar of France, which made every 10th day, rather than Sunday, the day of rest. And they did this for the purpose of eliminating Sunday worship. They wanted to get rid of any idea of a Lord's Day, and also to remove all festival days for the church in their calendar. They called this process de-Christianization. De-Christianization. We want to de-Christianize France. And that calendar actually remained in place for about a decade. In 1804, they got rid of it and went back to the normal 7-day calendar. But even after that, the vast majority of those feast days and saints days were no longer as part of a normal function. The process of de-Christianization was absolutely detrimental to French society, and especially for the welfare of the most oppressed and vulnerable. So no one ever thinks about it. No one ever thinks about if you get rid of Christianity, you actually lose the greatest force for good in your society. And at this point, it's important to remember that the church, and I'm talking the church universal here, Protestant, Eastern Orthodox, and Roman Catholic, the church in all of Europe basically held a monopoly on social welfare. And so when its influence and power was removed, it was those who were hurting the most that were left to hurt more. I just want to stop there and remind ourselves and cause us to think. We as a church, especially the American church, I think have forfeited a far too much of our duty and responsibility to the state. And because of that, I think the vast majority of the people are still left hurting today because the church refuses to step up to its call to be that force for good, that call for welfare to the world. And so it is amazing to me that when the church was cut off from its place of influence, it was those who were hurting most that were left hurting more. The people that the revolutionaries said they stood up for, the oppressed and the weak, but they just left them hurting more. Roman Catholics faced tremendous opposition and persecution during this time, and even the Pope was captured and taken to France as a prisoner where he would die there. When Napoleon took control in 1799, he realized that the majority of Frenchmen were still Roman Catholic. And in order to gain popular support, he proposed creating a liaison between the Roman Catholic Church and the state. And he did so by creating this document known as the Concordat of 1801, where he came to an agreement with Pope Pius VII, both of them pictured here in the picture above, both of them came to an agreement on working together to basically bring Rome back to some level of order. In this concordat, Napoleon recognized the Roman Catholic religion as, quote, the religion of the great majority of French citizens, end quote. However, he refused to make it an established religion. France would no longer have an established religion. That was important. They wanted to keep the state secular. However, he did want to note that it was the great majority of French citizens and therefore was a vital worldview within their society. The purpose of the Concordat was to govern the relationship between the church and the state in France, and so did so rather effectively until 1905. So for over 100 years, the Concordat of 1801 was kind of the primary relationship between church and state within France. However, the organic articles of 1802 provided that papal bulls could not be published nor synods held in France without the explicit permission of the government. And so this pope can't be coming here excommunicating people without the permission of Napoleon and other leaders. And so that was a big thing. The church was basically given a place of importance, but not given a place of authority. And that was could cause create greater issues in the future. Though the church was fully recognized and promoted in France, it remained under the watchful eye and control of the state until 1905, when it was finally and fully separated from the state. So there was really no separation of church and state in France until 1905. In 1804, the Pope came to France and was met with widespread enthusiasm, especially as the charismatic leadership of Pius VII crowned Napoleon emperor during his visit. This was the goal. The goal was to once again establish a Roman Empire, a Holy Roman Empire, with Napoleon as the new found emperor. And they thought that this was going to be very much a Charlemagne all over again, being crowned in Paris, in France, and once again a Frankish king establishing a Roman and a fully Catholic empire. But you can imagine all of these nation states were developing, and they weren't into the idea of having another empire, especially England. This was the beginning of a new Catholic activism, which was further strengthened when Napoleon seized papal territory in Italy and basically placed Pius in prison. The guy who thought he was crowning the emperor, who was going to create another Catholic empire, rides into Italy, takes the papal territories, and basically Pius stays imprisoned in the Vatican up until 1809. England saw Napoleon as an enemy, and thus even they began to sympathize with the Pope and accepted Catholic priests and monks as refugees from Western Europe. Obviously, you can imagine there was still a lot of hostility up to this point between England and Catholicism, but they hated Napoleon even more. And so they were like, come on and get over here to England and we'll take you in. Now, I want to, before I move any further with the specificities of Roman Catholicism, I want to talk about a brief aside here, just relating to the aftermath of revolutions, all of the revolutions, and the rise of the European nation states. Now, this, like I said, this does not specifically deal with Roman Catholicism, but it affects every other thing we're going to talk about from this point forward. And so I want to talk about this because it gives us the context by which every aspect of Christianity would deal with throughout the 19th century. After Napoleon's defeat at the Battle of Waterloo, the last remaining Bourbon king, Louis XVIII, was made king of France. And the overwhelming majority of the nation's leaders had no desire in reestablishing a Holy Roman Empire. And so the only clergymen who remained, who regained any ecclesiastical territory or authority was the Pope himself. No one else gained any territory. The Pope simply gained the Vatican ground there in Italy. And he's the only one that got any kind of ecclesiastical territory in the process. Throughout Europe, the rhetoric of revolution and the traumas of war left in the wake new possibilities, particularly this new idea that had never really been seen before except in the Americas with the American Revolution, and that was the idea that ordinary people had a say in shaping their own destinies. This was an idea that really flew very much out of the American Revolution. As the Industrial Revolution, based on steam power, spread its race through Britain, basically creating economically suitable enclaves as far away as Russia, large populations were drawn to these new manufacturing communities. Why are the vast majority of our cities overpopulated now? It's because that's where the work was during the time. That's where work was. That's where jobs were. So people flocked to the cities to get involved where there was work. New inventions in the 19th century changed the world forevermore. The steam power railroad, the electric telegraph, and then later on, the telephone. These things changed things radically. Now you could talk to people across the continent, across nations. And this had never been done before with this kind of expediency. The sacred monarchy had been destroyed by the revolutions and was replaced by a nationalism whose project was to replace a patchwork of jurisdictions, dialects, and loyalties with a centralized government. That really becomes the idea, a centralized government, especially in Europe. During this century, nationalism became an emotional replacement for Christianity. And they had basically, a lot of people had given up Christianity because of the rise of the Enlightenment. And nationalism kind of filled that hole. I can be proud of my country. I can fight for my nation, my manifest destiny to spread, right? And that was very much the case with a lot of the Western frontiersmen in America. Most of them had abandoned the Puritanism of their fathers and left to go create their own destiny. Very much man-centered and all of those things. And a lot of the cults will come out of that mindset as well. France, Belgium, Germany, and Italy all greatly moved towards this profound sense of nationalism. And alongside this nationalism came new economic struggles as well as bringing a struggle of new elites from the industrial period against the old elites. A vast majority of the middle class groups began to rise up and form worker unions and institutions at the most base and innocent level to share power and land with the aristocracy who had controlled those things for centuries. The earliest forms of these unions and institutions really were honorable. They desired to build society on a meritocracy, which rewarded personal achievement and ability rather than one's natural birth, which is what the aristocracy was built on. You just need to be born into this family. And these original worker unions and institutions wanted to simply have the ability to voice their opinions on politics and religions as they wished, and simultaneously be able to work hard and be paid and rewarded for their merits. And I think, in many ways, that was what we get the idea of the American dream, was the idea of these early concepts of union and institution. And this idea of a meritocracy with the ability to voice one's opinions freely on politics and religion became the basis for the ideology which is known as classical liberalism. Now, liberalism has taken a very bad name today, obviously, but really the vast majority of Americans today, even the most conservative Americans, are classical liberals in a lot of ways. They believe in a meritocracy and they believe in the freedom to voice their opinions and to think freely upon their own ideas and opinions. So a lot of the vast majority of people today, even if they're hyper-conservative, are still what we would call classical liberals. It just means they want to freely think for themselves. However, the ideas of liberty and equality, like always, would soon not be enough for some groups. We need more than just liberty and equality. With the rise of Romanticism came a radically anti-biblical view of man, which saw all mankind as naturally good, who had been oppressed and chained by a privileged group of elites. Sound familiar? It's amazing just how this stuff comes back up, doesn't it? Many began to call for a fraternity of the oppressed to join together in a brotherhood and to confront the oppressors from the old monarchical class and the new wealthy elites that the Industrial Revolution had created. And almost out of nowhere in the 1830s, a radical new form of politics arose in Britain and France, and it took the name socialism. Socialists asserted that without the distortions of inequality or poverty, people would treat others with compassion, love, and kindness. There was no inequality, there was no poverty, there would be no reason for anyone to ever steal or anyone to ever do bad. And if everyone just had the same slate, the same thing, if it was just total equity across the board, the world would just be peaceful. And everybody would treat each other like they did in the perfect state of nature beforehand. This radical system was really a restatement of enlightened optimism. That's really all it was. But with one interesting addition. While despising Christianity, this new form of socialism co-opted the Christian ethic of love and said, the reason that we should go to this and be totally equity and redistribute wealth and power is because we love our neighbor. And that was a powerful pull on a lot of Christians. This idea of co-opting love for neighbor, while simultaneously hating the system that gave them that basis. One of the leading proponents of the movement was a Scottish man named Robert Owens, who desired to take this system to America. And when he got to America, he arrived in Indiana, of all places, and he found nothing but rejection for his ideas. They hated this idea of socialism and redistributing wealth and power and co-opting this. Why? Because the vast majority of these Indiana frontiersmen then were all based upon this idea of rugged individualism. The American spirit, manifest destiny. We don't want to co-opt each other here. We're not trying to live in communes and be all about this. We want to go and make our own and make something for ourselves. The idea of meritocracy, right? I'm going to go and stake my claim and create my own little kingdom. And that was the idea. I don't want to share it with people. I want to go make it for my own. And so he comes to America and just absolutely gets crushed. They are not interested in this socialist idea. Now, if it had been 2 centuries later, he'd have probably been made president. So it was just shows you how things have quite changed for them. Many of the immigrants who had come to America found opportunity and reason to be optimistic by making it their own. They did not want to adopt the systems of Europe. They had fled from Europe to get away from those systems, and they came here on the idea of being able to make it something of themselves, to find a land of opportunity, to have the pursuit of happiness, the ability to actually go out and do something for themselves, not to continue to go back to the poor living conditions they left Europe for. Back in Europe, however, many did not see this radical ideology as much of a threat, and that was a mistake, especially with a new generation of theorists who transformed socialism into an even more radical system. In 1840, Frederick Engels used his personal connections with English industry to construct a description of social ills of contemporary English society, going on to identify that the cause and solution of all ills and injustices was class conflict. Class conflict. Everything boils down to classes. If you destroy classes, you destroy conflict. That was the idea of Engels. His friend, Karl Marx, applied this socialist idea and rhetoric to a new rigorous system and established a philosophy of both the past and the future on that system. You see, Marx was in many ways, we would call a communist prophet. He held a vision that all of the world would eventually come into an inevitable consummation into what he called the dictatorship of the proletariat. And there were two groups in Engels and Marx system. There were the proletariat, which are the oppressed working class people, and there were the bourgeoisie. These were the upper middle class, rich aristocrats above there. And these classes up here exist for the sole purpose of oppressing these lower groups. You have to destroy these classes, they said, for there to ever be peace in the world. And that is something that he saw as happening one day. Eventually, the proletariat would crush out the bourgeoisie and rule the world in this socialist, communist utopia. That's what it would be. It was his millennial kingdom. And that'd make a good book, Marx's Millennial Kingdom. Maybe I'll write something like that one day. I had to write that down and remember that. That could be an interesting study. But his vision, especially when you read the Communist Manifesto, is what you would see in any kind of the prophetic and apocalyptic vision that became so popular amongst false Christian teachers during this time, especially when we get to the Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the other cults. This idea of creating a utopian society. It's what led Brigham Young to take people to Salt Lake. This idea of a utopia where we're going to live and establish our millennial kingdom. What was so unique about this new ideology that Marx was proposing was that unlike other forms of socialism, it had a fixed commitment to materialism and a rejection of all religion. Whereas the earlier forms of socialism at least co-opted the love for neighbor concept, it said religion is the opiate of the masses. All it does is distract people from freeing themselves from the burden of their oppressors. We don't need religion. Religion is a way in which the oppressors keep you oppressed. That was the idea. It's why everybody today who wants to jump on these Marxist movements, who are Christians, well, we're just doing it for equality. You can't have your cake and eat it too. And that's the issue. The same systems that they're marching down the roads with right now are the same systems that will turn around when it's all said and done and chop their heads off because they hate them. They see Christianity as an oppressor. And Marx was very clear about that. Engels and Marx founded the League of the Just in 1847 before ultimately changing the name to the League of Communists. This was where the foundation and beginning of communism was founded. The growing proportion of socialists looked forward to Marx's prophetic scheme of the future and regarded Christianity as an enemy to be removed. Christians in the 19th century had to deal with the rise of liberalism, socialism, communism, and nationalism. And it would truly have to pick who its enemies were indeed, sometimes adopting some of the tactics of their enemies and becoming much more like their enemy than they did standing against it. And how they would combat these forces was anything but monolithic. They did a lot of different things to try and combat it. But with that being said, we now turn our attention back to Roman Catholicism specifically for the rest of the lecture. And we talk about really kind of its high point of the 19th century. In a period that can be defined by Ultramontanism and the rise of the papacy. This is from 1815 to 1870. Many Catholic churches were the target of the shifting landscapes because of how many of the clergy had come from aristocratic backgrounds. It doesn't help when you have a society that wants to overthrow the aristocrat and all of your clergy are aristocrats or have come from upper class families. And this caused a shift in the dynamics of the clergy as many began to come up from the proletariat ranks, these upper kind of working class, low poor class clergy that had never been able to serve in those offices before. Many clergy, because of the way in which the world was turning against the aristocracy, looked back now to the Pope for hope. They looked back for the Pope to try and provide some kind of stability for them once again. And this always happens in revolution. When chaos ensues, people look for one single leader who gives them hope and grasp, no matter who that leader is. And that is what happens here with the Roman Catholic Church. In all of the chaos, they look back to the Pope to give them direction. This movement had long bore the name Ultramontanism, and it gets its name from the idea of back in the past when the Catholic people in Northern Europe had to look beyond the mountains, Ultramonta, looking beyond the mountains, beyond the Alps, to look to Italy in order to reverence the Pope's authority. So this idea of Ultramontanism is simply a renewed interest in recognizing the Pope's authority. And that's really ultimately what it comes from. After 1850, the papacy represented Europe's last elected monarchy. And as such, it represented a bastion of the old world. In other words, if you wanted to be a conservative at this time, you tried to hold on to the old world. You tried to hold on to something from the past. And that was the old Roman church, this kind of old school, traditional, authoritative Catholicism. And the Pope saw this. And this idea of ultramontanism, people wanting to revive the Pope's power again, sought to revive the periods of Gregory the Great and Innocent III, this period of papal supremacy that had happened centuries earlier. Ultramontanism built up a new emotional power by reviving these old Catholic practices. There started to be pilgrim groups again. We want to start doing pilgrimages. They began to develop new orders, new Catholic orders, that all of a sudden began to explode left and right. But this time it had a very interesting dynamic. Rather than past orders that had been created, like the Jesuits and the Franciscans and so many others, all of these new orders that began to pop up in the mid-19th century were characterized by a growing number of women, not men. And for the first time ever, women outnumber clergy. Nuns outnumber clergy in the Catholic orders. It went from 1760 to 1860, that one century, it went from 60-40 ratio from male priests to female nuns to 60 female nuns to every 40 priests. Totally flipped within a century as female nuns took up kind of the charge and the beacon of holding on to the bastion of Roman Catholic and papal supremacy. And what would have been a horror to any bishop at the Council of Trent, this was a huge change in that only 10% of these nuns were in a contemplative order. And the Council of Trent, which was kind of the response to the Reformation in the 16th century, if you remember that, when there was the form of nunneries and creating orders for women, the whole role for women was merely to be a contemplative order. They do quiet work, they do service amongst one another, but that was only 10% of these new orders. The rest of them were doing teaching, they were doing social work, providing health care, and this would have made every single pope from the 16th century on before roll in their graves. What do you mean we have women teaching and leading in the church like that? That would have not been happening. But this became the new shift. And with this emphasis on women, there was one woman in particular, more than anyone else, who bolted to the top of Catholic thought in the 19th century. And that was the mother of Jesus herself, Mary. More than at any time in history, visions of Mary was said to be happening all across the Roman Catholic world. And it was always to the same kind of person. It was usually to women, almost always to women who were in an area of a lot of upheaval, whether it be political or economic. It was usually in these rough places that Mary always seemed to appear to these women. And what even came really interesting and what really started to mark a lot of controversy from the more, we would say, rationally minded Catholics was the rise that many of these visions began to be paralleled with other events like stigmata. You ever heard of stigmata? Stigmata, the idea of the wounds of Jesus appearing on the hands, bleeding hands, and wounds appearing upon people. That began to become a thing. Now, originally, the idea of stigmata began with Francis of Assisi. Francis of Assisi claimed to get stigmata and those signs, but now it was almost all women that were claiming to have these visions, and then those visions were being paralleled by images of stigmata. Mary was moving ever more to the top of Catholic worship and practice. And Pope Pius IX forever solidified Mariolatry in Catholic dogma when in 1854, in the papal bull, in Ineffabilis Deus, he proclaimed the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception of Mary as dogma. And that is the idea that Mary was conceived without any taint of original sin. She was born and never touched with original sin whatsoever. And when he proclaimed this as ex fide, he declared that all faithful Catholics were to accept this doctrine as a part of the official dogma of the Roman Catholic Church that one must believe in order to be saved. So according to Catholic dogma, based upon the 1854 papal bull by Pope Pius IX, in order to be saved, you must believe that Mary was born without original or without original sin. That they have to believe. It's not like, we're debating over it. This was a de fide. This was a dogma now of the Roman Catholic Church. Other major events during this period helped further strengthen Roman Catholicism in the 19th century. The Jesuits, who had been disbanded by Clement XIV in 1773, were reconstituted in 1814 and immediately went back to their work of educational missionary activities. The Jesuits maintained kind of the dominant missionary force for Roman Catholicism, and really even to this day. And perhaps the most shocking turn of all that benefited the Catholic Church was a growing acceptance by and conversion of many Anglicans in England back to Roman Catholicism. And this was known as the Oxford Movement. In 1845, Henry Edward Manning and John Henry Newman joined the Roman Catholic Church, and by 1862, about 625 important English leaders and nearly 250 Anglican clergy became Roman Catholics. And Newman especially is important because he kind of becomes the primary apologist for Rome against Protestantism. He comes out of Protestantism, and Newman is a historian. And one of the issues that he has to deal with is this idea of this is the one true church, and this one true church has to be constant and consistent in all of its teachings. But he's not stupid. He can look through history and go, there's been lots of changes in Rome. So what do we do? And he creates the developmental hypothesis. And that is the idea that he takes the parable of the mustard seed. And he uses the mustard seed not as a reflection of the church in number, but as the church in its doctrine. When the apostles were here, they just had the mustard seed. And as the church has branched out over history, it has been able to create more doctrine and have further understanding because it now is the big mustard tree. And so they can teach things that the apostles didn't teach because they have further revelation now that the apostles didn't have. So you can see how they're able to get around when you start saying things, well, the apostles didn't teach the Immaculate Conception of Mary, or the bodily assumption of Mary, or transubstantiation, or other things like that. They would say, yeah, we know they didn't. But there's oral tradition that's been passed down through the church, and you say, well, can you give me a list of that? And they'd say, well, go read the dogmas. That's basically what they would say to you. And ultimately, what made this all so easy was that the high church Anglicanism that was very Arminian, almost Pelagian, made it very easy to transition right back to Rome. The moment you get rid of the doctrines of grace, the moment you get rid of the reality that God's grace alone is the means by which we are all saved, you're already swimming back to Rome. You might as well go back over there. At that point, you're a Roman Catholic. When you say it's God and me, at any point, the only reason you're not a Catholic is because you don't like the smells and veils. That's about it. But doctrinally, you're already heading that direction. And that was the case for these high church Anglicans. As Pius further began to notice the nationalism and the political liberalism, which was often hostile to Roman Catholicism, he issued the Syllabus of Errors in 1864. In this work, Pius condemned many of the new forms of philosophy which were rising up in the day. One of these being idealism, with its tendency towards pantheism, religious tolerance, separation of church and state, socialism, the rise of Bible societies, secular school systems, attacks on papal power, the rise of civil marriage, and the rise of higher biblical criticism. He believed that all these things were destructive to the church. So if you want to realize this, and this is just a perfect example today, if you look at the Pope today, he is nothing like the popes of the 19th century. They were as conservative as it gets, man. And they were nothing like Pope Frankie today. So there is already, within two centuries, a century and a half, you can see a massive shift in the kind of conservatism that marked old school Catholicism to the very new school universalist Catholicism of today. Pius believed that all of those things said above were destructive. And so he published the Syllabus of Errors to write against them. And then in 1863, he upheld the idea of unum sanctum. And that is the idea that salvation is only found in the Roman Catholic Church. You can't find it anywhere else. Which, once again, that's old school Catholicism. It's hard to find those kind of Catholics today, but that is what Catholicism originally taught and still is taught in their catechisms and things like that. However, it was 1870 that marked the height of Pius's papal work, when at the Vatican Council, the declaration of papal infallibility was approved. It wasn't until 1870 that the Church declared as a dogma that when Pope spoke ex cathedra on matters of morals and faith, it was infallible. The same authority as Scripture. It was infallible. Now, we could talk about how wrong that is, but the real shocking is it wasn't until 1870 that that became an actual doctrine, a dogma of the Church. The doctrine made church councils unnecessary. We don't need to have councils. So even in the Vatican Council in the 60s was nothing more than kind of a, you know, this is where we're going with it, and we'll look at that down the road. But nevertheless, what's interesting is only when he speaks ex cathedra is it infallible. And what's amazing is there's only been one time since 1870 that the Pope has used an ex cathedra infallible statement. And it was when, in 1950, the Pope declared the bodily assumption of Mary as de fide, as a dogma. And that is the idea that Mary never died. She was assumed into heaven, like Elijah and others. She never died. And that became another dogma, a necessary to believe in order to be saved in the Roman Catholic Church. And he hasn't used an ex cathedra since. And there's a reason why. Because you can say whatever you want and just say, oh, I didn't say ex cathedra. And so that is really the reason why for that. This caused one group to break away and start what is known as the Old Catholic Church. There were lots of Catholics who did not agree with papal infallibility. They said, how in the world are we going to explain the Avignon papacy and these other evil periods if we say popes are infallible? You just ruin any apologetic we have. And so lots of Catholics broke away and started what is known as the Old Catholic Church under the leadership of a man named Johann von Dollinger, who was excommunicated in 1871 for his refusal to accept the decree of papal infallibility. And this brings us to our final portion of discussion. Basically, a new resistance rises against the papacy, the area of 1870 to 1914. What had established papal heights in 1870 with the doctrine of papal infallibility also served as its pivot point for where it found a newfound resistance. The same year the Italian armies took Rome when Louis Napoleon had to withdraw the French garrison, protecting the papacy in order to meet the Franco-Prussian War. And the Pope lost all his temporal possessions in Italy, with the exception of one area known as the Vatican. And that's still today. It's his own little sovereign area. The Pope, however, would not come to terms with the new national constitutional monarchy, despite the generous offer held out by the law of papal guarantees, which the Italian government established. The law offered the Pope $645,000 annually for the loss of his land, and self-government of the Vatican with absolutely no interference by the state. And the Pope refused, and basically retired to a self-imposed imprisonment in the Vatican, which would remain until the papacy came to an agreement with the government by a man named Benito Mussolini in 1929. Roman Catholicism also ran into major issues in Germany because of a leader there named Chancellor Bismarck, who believed that it got in the way of his hopes for an entire unification of all the Germanic people into a Germanic empire. The Germans have always wanted to be have this kind of Germanic empire. And even as early as Bismarck, you can start kind of seeing an underpinning of what would later be fully and most perversely established with Hitler's idea of Arianism. And this idea of the Germanic people have some kind of special aura about them. They are powerful, Viking-like people. They are the supreme picture of evolution, which is coming here very soon down the line. But nevertheless, they eased up sanctions on Roman Catholicism because they saw Roman Catholicism as actually a great ally against socialism. Socialism sought to destroy the chancellor's kind of power, and he was like, well, Rome hates socialism, so we'll kind of buddy up with them for the time being. The strongest anti-clerical feeling during this period, however, was in France. In 1901, religious orders of nuns and monks were excluded by law from educational activities. But the severest blow came in 1905 with the passing of the separation law by the French Chamber of Deputies. Clergy were no longer to be paid by the state, and all the church property was to be taken over by the state. Churchmen had to form themselves into associations, and once again, they had to get permission and a permit by the state in order to do religious services on any property. The state no longer recognized any faith in a special manner, and thus Roman Catholicism lost the privileged position that it held with the Concordat of 1801 that had been established with Napoleon. Pope Leo XIII, which is pictured above, had made multiple attempts to oppose the power of the nation states by publishing several encyclicals and one papal bull titled Immortal Dei in 1885, which he stated that the state had failed to recognize God's authority through the church. In 1891, Leo also asserted the moral rights of the church in economics as well as politics by issuing the papal bull Rerum Novarum. In this, he wrote that the state should recognize private property as a natural right and the legitimate existence of classes. Workers have a right to cooperate in unions, and the state should act to alleviate injustices against workers and ensure that they are being paid a livable wage. And this idea was to try and outflank the liberals. It was to try and outflank the liberals at their own game. And this was all kind of the act there. Really, like I said, the Roman Catholic Church of the 19th century was the bastion of conservatism. It really was. In many ways, that put a lot of Protestantism to shame. Because Protestantism in Europe in the 19th century, with the exception of a few areas, would become very liberal, especially German Protestantism. His theology, Leo argued that Aquinas should be the supreme theologian studied in Roman Catholic schools and seminaries, and in his bull, Providentiismus, in 1893, he upheld the doctrine of biblical inerrancy, actually, which at this time was under complete attack by the German higher critics. Leo's successor, Pius X, continued to protect Rome from the growing liberalism that was becoming more and more pervasive throughout Christianity, and further attacked the Roman Catholic Church through new entities which had developed out of the Scottish Reformation, an entity known as the Freemasons. Freemasons actually came out of the Scottish Reformation, I don't know that, and they went way off the deep end and began adopting signs and ideologies, and they really were a movement that sought to take out all other areas of what they saw as power. They sought to take out and remove all power structures. We're not going to get too deep in the stigma around Freemasonry, that we could be here forever. But nevertheless, they were one of the vital leaders in trying to attack the established church of the period. He excommunicated two of the leading Catholic higher critics, Alfred Louis and George Tyrrell, for trying to write works that sought to undermine biblical inerrancy. At this point, Rome, in contrast to European Protestantism, had remained mostly steadfast against the liberalism which rose up because of modernity. And this would be the case until 1914, when a world war would shift the religious and social landscape of the world, placing the Roman Catholic Church under much difficulty. A lot of the places where the war went was areas where Roman Catholicism had a lot of influence. And the war, especially World War I, really created a dark pessimism over society. With the rise of evolution, modernity, and world wars, that really took a big hit. And it wasn't until post-World War II that religion would really find an upsurge once again. Not really even until the 50s, and primarily in America, as America sought to fight godless communism. And Christianity and patriotism became very much blended. That's where we will stop tonight as we look forward to other areas of Christianity, but that covers Catholicism primarily for the 19th century up until World War I. And so next time we are together, we'll turn our attention to some of the other major thinkers and the developments within Protestantism within Europe during the same period. Let's pray.